All right, Rosie. If you're so smart, I challenge you to a game of chess. I'll even let you play white. Go ahead, make the first move. The Durkin opening? Nobody does that. You really want to develop your queen's knight that way? All right, see what I do with my pawn. Very intriguing, but what if I use the Grunfeld defense, like this? Huh. I didn't foresee that use of your bishop, but surely there's a way I can... Four moves? No, you totally do not have me checkmated in four moves. Anyway, I never should have let you go first. And I'm letting you concentrate way too much. I wish I were an Oscar Mayer wiener. Ha, let's see you concentrate while I'm singing that. Immature? Oh, I love that. The one who isn't wearing pants is calling me immature. The one who's making a crude attempt to fianchetto his bishop is calling me... Did you just checkmate me? Look, if we could just keep this between the two of us, I know I got a little testy a minute ago, but if word got around that a pig beat me in chess... I know there's no shame in it, but people are really going to make fun of me. I could really get roasted for this, you know? Yeah, you're right. Bad word choice. And you probably don't like grilled either, huh? Today on the show, a salute to the smartest animal most of us will ever eat. And now, the guy who brings home the tofu, Colin McEnroe.
Actually, even as I speak, a pig is walking right near me. As Rosie has chosen this exact moment. We have a pig in the studio, a pot-bellied pig named Rosie. One of our many guests, I think counting Rosie, we have 9 guests on this show. This is a pig extravaganza, although Rosie is the only actual pig present for it. We're going to be talking about the noble pig in a lot of different contexts, just what it is as an animal, some of the ways that we use it, some of the religious prohibitions against eating it. We'll try to explore as many things about the pig as possible. Let me tell you a little bit about some of the people who are here. I already mentioned Rosie. She lives at Flamig Farm in West Simsbury, and Rosie's owners, Nevin and Julie Christensen, who are the owners of Flamig Farm, are here with us. So are Abby and Kevin Bassett, who are the operators of Killam and Bassett Farmstead in South Glastonbury, where they raise their own pigs and sell their own pork. In a little while, you're going to meet Dorothy Martin Neville. She's an ex-nun, therapist, speaker, and author. She and Stephen Blackburn, the library director and faculty associate in Semitic Scriptures at Hartford Seminary, are going to talk a little bit about why some cultures don't eat pigs. And who am I leaving out? Oh, we have a couple of scientists specializing in pig intelligence. And a little bit, you're going to meet Mark Beckoff. He's a professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And we're going to start out our conversation with Jeremy Marchant Ford, a research animal scientist for the USDA, and actually the author of The Welfare of Pigs. I think that's the name of the book. He's the editor of The Welfare of Pigs, a comprehensive text about pig welfare, as the title might suggest. So let me actually sort of pull him up here. He's going to sort of get the conversation going for us. And Rosie, the actual pig we have in studio, may chime in at any moment. Jeremy Marchant Ford, are you there?
I hope so.
Oh, good. And am I saying your name correctly?
Yes, pretty close.
Close enough? Okay. Close enough for pigs. So I want to talk a little bit about pig intelligence, pig cognition. I think people maybe, if they have any kind of general idea about this, maybe have heard or read somewhere that pigs have an extraordinarily high level of intelligence. This is something that's been studied a lot of different places. Is there a way that we can put them in a specific spot on the spectrum of animal cognition?
I think that's quite difficult, but I know certainly there's been a study done looking at, I think, animal science and veterinary science students and faculty, and they were asked to kind of rank intelligence of various domestic species, and the pig did come in at number 3 on that rank, just under dogs were the top, then cats, and then pigs.
Now, pigs have been taught or can be studied while they are doing some pretty impressive feats. Why don't you mention one or two things, either experiments or observations of yours that kind of suggest the kinds of intelligence that a pig has?
Oh, indeed. I mean, you've already mentioned the work done by Stan Curtis and Candace Crony there with the pigs playing video games, which, of course, is a study that at the time got a lot of exposure in terms of the pig's ability to, you know, move the ball with the joystick using its snout.
Yeah, and actually Curtis said at the time, this is the late Stanley Curtis, he actually said that pigs did it a lot better than dogs, and you can actually see video of this online pretty easily, that pigs were a lot better at this than dogs. Some of that might have to do with the dexterity of their snout, their ability to coordinate their snout and their eye, but also he said that pigs were kind of, he sort of said they were at the level of less intelligent chimps, that to whatever extent there are smarter chimps and maybe not so bright chimps, the pigs could do this pretty well, pretty much as well as the less intelligent chimps.
Right, and I mean, always the important thing is the way that you ask the questions. Clearly, of course, chimps, you know, it's easy for us as humans to kind of devise tests for chimps that involve using hands, mm-hmm. you know, in order to perform tasks. With pigs, obviously, you've got to choose a different way of testing things. And invariably, most of what we do, in fact, is using that snout, which is a very important part of the pig. Vision, in fact, is not particularly good in pigs. So where we're expecting them to do things which needs eyesight and good eyesight, then often we're not necessarily asking the question the right way. Smell is a much, much more important sense for them. And then, of course, in terms of what will they work for, helping them learn things, will work for food is invariably, you know, the reward that we use.
Yeah, I was telling one of the farmers here about the Penn State experiment, and he said, I assume food was part of this, because
Absolutely.
Otherwise, why bother? That would be a pig's attitude about that. You know, we should mention, I mean, there have been some really remarkable pig studies, but I know the one that you're very familiar with and got a lot of publicity, and it's a hard experiment to describe logistically, but the experiment that Professor Donald Broom did with the mirror, do you feel up to trying to explain this?
Right, yes. This was the idea that, you know, could pigs look in the mirror and use the reflection or the information that's coming from that reflection in the mirror to locate food, again, a bowl of food within a pen, so behind a barrier. So directly the pig could not see the food in the bowl, but if it looked at an angle across at the mirror, you know, you could find out, work out within the pen where the food bowl was and get to it.
But this required doing a kind of visual reverse engineering of the pig's environment, an apprehension of what it was seeing in the mirror, and then an orientation of itself a coordinating of the image in the mirror with what the pig could see of its environment. And the pigs were doing this in really matters of seconds, it seemed.
So long as they were used to the mirror.
Right,
so
right.
He used, you know, naive pigs and pigs that had been left in that pen with the mirror, without the food there, but with the mirror for, I think, about 5 hours. So, you know, with those experienced pigs, then yes, they were very, very quick to locate the food in the position using the mirror.
Yeah, actually,
but
I read...
Pigs that were naive, they couldn't do that.
Right. I read that study, and that was my favorite phrase, the naive pigs.
Right.
Well, you know, as long as we're talking about mirrors, one of the typical measures of animal intelligence, and it's probably an unfair one or one that has a lot to do with how we ask the questions, as you put it, as opposed to what's there to be found and seen. But for some reason or other, experimenters kind of obsess about this question about whether animals can recognize themselves in a mirror, can look in a mirror and understand that they're seeing themselves. Although I think gorillas can't even do this. I assume pigs can't look in the mirror and see themselves.
Right. We really have not sort of done that experiment, and we haven't got the evidence to suggest that they can, you know, when they're looking in the mirror, they're seeing a pig rather than self.
What can you tell us about pigs as social animals, about what they understand about themselves and others? I mean, I know that in the wild, you know, or left to their own devices, pigs are going to kind of congregate in certain social groups. There's even a wonderful collective name, the Sounder.
Mm-hmm.
The Sounder is a group of pigs. What can you tell us about sort of how pigs interact with one another?
They exist as family groups. So the Sounder is really, it's very much a female-oriented group. It's a sow, usually, either with her sisters or with some of her daughters. Group size is not particularly big, probably only maybe 2 to 4 sows. They'll have associated piglets with them. In terms of the social cohesion within that group, or the social structure, there will be, you know, a pecking order, the classic pecking order, a dominance order. So there will be a boss sow, and then there will be less dominant and subordinate sows within that, and the piglets below that. And in terms of, you know, how do they recognize each other and maintain that kind of relationship, most of the information is, I mean, there's physical information. I mean, they will fight to establish social order, but once it's established, it's pretty much stable. Thereafter, it's threat. Recognition will be done, you know, olfactory primarily. They're very olfactory animals. And in fact, it's still quite unknown the degree to which what information is contained within the kind of pheromone signals that they give to each other.
I have to ask a question, and this question is based on my incredibly dilettantish acquaintance with studies of pig cognition, based on really the last 2.5 days of reading everything that I could get my hands on. But one of the things that struck me was a lot of the experiments, the preponderance of the experiments that I happened to find, and even looking down the list at your book, The Welfare of Pigs, and seeing the contributors and recognizing some of the names, you know, it's all in Bristol and Newcastle and maybe a little bit in the Netherlands and, you know, Stanley Curtis notwithstanding. Am I wrong in thinking that a lot of the really interesting research that's going on in pig cognition is happening in the United Kingdom or elsewhere in Europe?
Probably so, yes. I mean, I think so. Clearly, you know, as you can tell, I'm here in the US. I have been for the last 12 years. But I originated out of the UK, out of the Cambridge group, and also as an undergraduate at Bristol as well. Yes, a lot of, you know, Scandinavia as well, another series of countries that have always had very high regard for welfare of farm animals. And, you know, wherever you get public concern about the welfare of farm animals, you tend to get a predominance of research looking into these types of questions.
Because every study that I read would conclude, the abstract would conclude, this may have implications for the welfare of pigs or, you know, how they're handled and how they're stored. We're going to be talking to some farmers in just a second here, and I know that also you have something else that you have to do. We're going to let you go in just a second. But in general, based on everything that you know about the welfare of pigs and about pig cognition, I mean, what would you like to see in terms of how pigs are handled? I mean, that's a question that has a 4-hour answer, probably. But if there were one thing that you could change, what would you change?
Oh gosh, one thing that I could change. I think that, you know, that's a very difficult one.
Yeah.
Like you say, it's a program in itself, I'm sure. And
well, maybe
I mean,
we'll,
you know, it's a question that it's not just down to about the practicalities of it. You know, it does touch on the ethics of how you keep them and things like that as well. You know, so there's a lot of science involved. And we're still seeking scientific answers on best practice and things like that. But, you know, again, there is also an ethical or moral aspect that comes into play, you know, and sometimes these agree with the science and sometimes they don't necessarily.
That's a very good answer, actually. Jeremy Marchant-Ford, thanks so much for joining us, a research animal scientist for the USDA and the editor of the book The Welfare of Pigs. Great to talk to you. I'm going to turn the conversation now to the farmers in the studio here. We've got two farms represented. One of them is Flambig Farm in West Simsbury, which is those of you who've been there, is I should let the farmers describe it, but it's a farm that's an educational farm and oriented and sort of a petting zoo and stuff like that, although sort of as a backdrop to that, there is sort of some real farming going on there as well. And then Killam and Bassett, and they do farmers markets all over the state. They also have their own farm stand there in South Glastonbury. Just to help you get acquainted and get oriented. But first of all, I'm just going to ask the farmers a little bit, you know, what you've learned about pigs handling them. Kevin, maybe you can sort of start out. You just listened to a research scientist talk a little bit about what he's been able to perceive about the intelligence and character of pigs. What else can you tell us?
I know we've always had pigs on the farm for personal consumption. I noticed right off the bat they are very intelligent. They will eat in one place, sleep in one place, go to the bathroom in another place, and they will learn. You can their voices or different times of the day, they know what's going to go on. So
that whole image that the pig has, I mean, one of the images the pig has, the pig is a dirty animal. But you're sort of saying the pig is kind of selective about where it does what, maybe in a way that a lot of other animals aren't?
Yes. A pig also will make its own wallow, but that's only to cool off in the mud.
And There's so many things we want to get into. And first of all, I also want to say our number, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. Julie, you've got a lot of animals there at Flambing Farm. Every time I go there, there's something that I haven't seen before. You got emus. You got, I don't know, you could name it all. So where do the Rosie's doing something over there. Where do the pigs rank in terms of sort of intelligence, behavior, sort of, you know, how you react to them and they react to you?
Well, they definitely know my car whenever I pull in, and they know that there's a donut or a cookie or something in there, and they start going crazy. Just like Kevin said, they're super smart. They like their bed a certain way. They like – Rosie actually uses a litter box, and if it gets too full, she rebels and tosses it around a bit. So they definitely are very neat, orderly animals, and – they like things a certain way, and they'll let you know when they're not happy, that's for sure.
Our number, 860-275-7266. Nevin, what about sort of how pigs interact with one another? You've had a lot of pigs in that farm over the years. I've been going to that farm for, I don't know, 20, 25 years, something like that. I've seen pigs come, and I've seen pigs go. You know, and you heard him talking about sounders and stuff like that. Obviously, a farm environment isn't kind of a pure environment where they can organize any way that they want. But have you seen things about how they interact with one another?
Oh, absolutely. Over the years, we've had pigs under different conditions, in pens. That's how the first ones were. And then we've had pigs where they could roam an acre and a half of land, and had two sows with all of their 10 or 12 babies roaming on that. You know, obviously, the more space they had, the calmer and happier everybody seemed. And they're very – this spring – really intense time. We had one mob give birth to a litter of pigs, and she managed to crush all but one, who became named Lucky. The next mom gave a birth to a litter of pigs and kept everyone alive, including this tiny little runt. Then months later, we introduced Lucky to try to get all the pigs into one place, and that mom almost killed him. She was just, no, you're not mine, get out of here. So, yeah, they're intense. They're you know, very social, and those are the extreme situations, I guess.
Yeah. And, Julie, so you were that's the pig you were talking about before, that there was a runt that you guys kind of saved?
Yes, my pet pig, Lucky. I love him. He actually slept in our bedroom for the first, week of his life, and he was harder than a newborn baby.
Weeks.
Yeah.
Okay. We were tired.
Nevin was exhausted.
But
I let him take that one.
But Rosie's a potbelly pig, and so Rosie, there's a limit for Rosie, whereas with Lucky –
Lucky will keep growing.
Yeah. How big will Lucky get?
900 pounds. He probably won't go on the elevator to come here.
Yeah, that's going to change your relationship with Lucky a little bit when Lucky gets that big. So we're talking about pigs. We're talking about pigs with pig farmers. So Abby, I don't know. You've heard everybody telling different stories about pigs. Actually, I'm going to ask you about something you said before we went on the air. You said, you know, having raised pigs for meat, you would never, ever get bacon from the grocery store again. Is that just because of the taste, or are there a lot of other reasons for that too?
It has to do with the taste mainly. It's got a totally different – I mean, it still tastes like bacon, but it tastes more like bacon than what you eat at the store. But, no, we don't add growth hormones. We don't add nitrates. We're not jam-packing our bacon or our pork products with any type of real bad preservatives that you find in most of the grocery stores.
Were you going to say something, Kevin?
No.
And I just, you know, I actually buy pork from farmers. It's the only way that I will buy pork. So I you know, buy from Eagle Brook and some of the other farmers around here. Rosie's decided she's got something she wants to tell me right now. And I mean, one of the things that I like about that is also, you know, I can visit the farm. I can see how the pigs are treated, too. I mean, I would assume.
I like to know where my meat comes from. Like,
yeah.
In all honesty, like, what am I putting into the meat? What am I actually consuming? Like, all of our porks, all of our pigs, they all get like fruits and vegetables that are left over from the markets. We give them a corn grain at the end of the day just to, you know, help bulk them up a little bit. And I don't know. I like it.
Yeah. We're going to take a little break here. We'd love to hear from you if you've got questions. 860-275-7266. The farmer's going to be here for the entire time. We're going to kind of come back to them a little bit more towards the end of the show with some other questions about pigs and pig farming. In the next segment, we're going to talk a little bit more about sort of attitudes towards pigs, which people eat pigs and which people don't.
Sleeps on straw, he calls it a rug. Yeah, it's a rug, okay. He's walking down the street and nobody's gonna argue with him. He's a half a ton of pygmy. Up in the hills, above the farm.
Okay, we're gonna talk a little bit in this segment about attitudes towards pigs and maybe more specifically attitudes towards pork, although the two obviously are deeply related to one another. Joining us is Stephen Blackburn. He's the library director and faculty associate in Semitic Scriptures at the Hartford Seminary, also an ordained clergyman. With us also, Dorothy Martin Neville, ex-nun, therapist, speaker, and author. And to lead things off, Mark Beckoff. He's a professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado at Boulder and the author of Why Dogs Hump and Bees Get Depressed. Obviously, we're all going to have to run out and buy that to find out the answer to both of those questions and more, Mark. But maybe you can sort of kick things off here. You know, earlier we talked to Jeremy Marchant Ford, who's a research animal scientist who specializes in the welfare of pigs. As somebody who looks at this from a slightly different angle, ecology and evolutionary biology, you know, what kind of animal is the pig in terms of its intelligence, in terms of the things that the values that that people place on certain kinds of animals? What can you say to us about the pig?
Well, you know, pigs are mammals like we are and like our domestic dog companions are. So we all share certain parts of the brain that are important in our, you know, cognitive, intellectual, and emotional lives. And so we know a lot about pigs. We know they're very smart, and we know they're very emotional. We know they're conscious and sentient beings. So they experience deep pain and, you know, contagious joy. So, I mean, that's kind of cutting through the chase on, you know, a lot of research. But that's how I would look at pigs. I would look at them as sentient, conscious beings who really care about what happens to them and their friends and their families.
Now, you're a vegan, so the food part of this conversation doesn't touch you directly, but I know it also interests you, sort of once again, in terms of how we make decisions about how pigs are raised, how pigs are treated, right?
Right. I mean, yes, I'm one of those vegans, and, you know, in the best of all possible worlds, maybe it would be nice if the whole world was vegetarian or vegan, but it won't be. So my take is that the animals who we use for food, not what we use, because they are who's, would be given the very, very best lives that they can as individuals. And then people are going to have to make the choices that suit them. I can't make any choices for other people in terms of, you know, whether they slaughter them for food. But the major obligation, of course, would be to give these pigs as individuals the very best lives we can give them while they're alive.
You know, there's been a lot of research, as I'm sure you're aware, into and some fairly cutting-edge research on pig genome. But even, you know, everything we've known about pigs genetically for a long time, and there's a scientist, I think he's at University of Illinois at Champaign, Dr. Lauren Shook, who's looked at the pig genome and said, you know, really big stretches of it are very close to the human genome. I mean, and in a lot of sort of structural ways, pigs are very similar to us. I mean, their hearts are similar to ours. It's why people have pig valves. They've been metabolize drugs in a similar way as to the way we do, so they're used sometimes in research for that reason. Their teeth resemble our teeth, and in some cases, their habits can. But one of the sort of temptations there for us, I think, is to place a higher value on an animal that's more like us and a higher value on an animal that we perceive as intelligent as opposed to stupid. I mean, I actually do feel a little worse somehow about eating a smart animal than I do about eating a stupid animal. But I'm not sure that that makes any sense. So react to that.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. I've written some papers on this, and actually in that book, Why Dogs Hump and Bees Get Depressed, I discuss the fact that there's no relationship at all between relative brain size. And as biologists, we calculate what's called the encephalization quotient, which is the brain relative to the body size, because, of course, an elephant has an absolutely larger brain than a mouse. There's no relationship between what we would call intelligence and degrees of suffering that's tied to brain size. Bees, for example, are really bright. They can do tasks that great apes can't do. And they actually have tiny brains with very relatively few neurons. So my response would be, people do, I think, feel badly or more badly about eating animals who they think are smarter or more emotional. but really it that relationship just doesn't hold.
I continue to eat pork, and in fact, but I am sort of insistent that I buy it from farmers like the ones who are here right now. I want to add some more other voices to this conversation. I'm going to start with Stephen Blackburn from the Hartford Seminary. There are religious traditions, obviously, within Judaism and Islam. There are religious traditions that proscribe against the eating of pork. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about why that is or where that comes from.
Well, if you were a believing Muslim or a believing Jew, you would simply say, well, this comes from God, and that is sufficient reason to not eat pork, although perhaps some of the more intellectually curious might want to, you know, look behind and try to figure out the mind of God, you know, in issuing such commands or such prohibitions. But, you know, the sociologists and the anthropologists and those involved in the history of human practices, you know, might say, well, there was a reason not to eat pork because the meat goes bad in the desert or it can't be kept fresh or preserved. But those would actually be secondary considerations for somebody who is, you know, practicing their religion.
Scripturally, it doesn't say pork exactly, right? Doesn't it say an animal that parts the hoof or something like that?
Right. Well, we are allowed to eat, and when I say we, I'm just now speaking members of the Jewish community, although I'm not Jewish. But we are allowed to eat animals whose hooves are split. But the thing is, pigs don't chew their cud. Mm-hmm. And so that there's the prohibition. You need to have a split hoof and chew your cud in order to be permitted for consumption. And the pig only fulfills half of that requirement.
And these are prescriptions, I mean, in the case of the tradition you're talking about right now, that are in the Old Testament. So, I mean, theoretically, Christians could follow these same rules, but don't, right?
Well, some Christians do. I mean, the Seventh-day Adventists quite specifically keep to many of those rules from Leviticus and Deuteronomy and other books of the Torah and the rest of the Hebrew Scripture. But there's the passage in the book of Acts in the Second Testament or the New Testament where God tells Peter that it is now lawful to eat many of these things which were unlawful before. And interestingly enough, both Judaism and Islam, for that matter, suggest that those rules in terms of prohibiting the eating of pork apply only to their communities. I mean, these are not universal rules that all of humanity is supposed to follow. And it's up to Christians, if they want to, you know, follow that part of the Torah, then they can go right ahead and not eat pork. And as I mentioned, the Seventh-day Adventists, a Protestant denomination, it follows that particular practice.
I'm going to switch over here just a second to Dorothy Martin Neville, another of our guests, sort of on the spiritual side of this. What's your take on these religious prohibitions against eating pork?
I think most of them are very pragmatic. There really was a fear about the bacteria and the diseases that could develop if we ate that. And so, therefore, they were against it. I think what happens at this point, though, is that there was a time when that was applicable. Most of us aren't roaming the desert anymore, and most of us are not in those conditions where we, at least listening to this radio show, where we need to worry about all of that type of poisoning or infestation in the food. So I think at this point it's more cultural. People follow even those who aren't practicing the various religions, it's part of the culture they grew up in.
How do you think people fit this into their daily modern lives? I mean, you're touching on this already, but I mean, obviously there are people who belong to religions that are fundamentalists, are evangelical, are trying to follow Scripture to the letter. And there seems to be sort of a whole bunch of other people who are trying, maybe in some of the ways that Mark is saying too, to sort of sort out their own attitudes, maybe even develop their own personal code about what animals to eat and what not to eat.
I think right now there's so much going on that is about this vegan who is online, this about looking at the different chemicals that are in the foods and things of that idea. So not eating meat has becoming more, I think, for many people about looking at one humane treatment. Even in these religions we're talking about, one of the rules in other things other than pork, if they're to eat meat, it has to be treated humanely. It has to be taken care of. Mm-hmm. And not the barbaric treatment that some of these animals are getting in various farms across the country.
Mark Beckoff, maybe you can say a little bit more about that, too. It does seem as though we've strayed away from the kind of, at least most of us have strayed away from the strict scriptural assertions that Stephen Blackburn's talking about. But everybody seems to maybe try either want to live an examined life and ask a lot of questions about this or just eat whatever's served to them. Americans are often talked about as having kind of this spiritual smorgasbord. Maybe you can comment a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, across the religious people I know who, worship and practice one religion or another, they're uniformly into thinking more about the humane treatment of the animals. And this is across cultures, and I travel a lot and in many, many different countries. So I think what they're doing is they're weaving in, and I mean, I don't know this as a fact, but among the people I know, they're weaving in a much deeper concern about the humane treatment of the animals who they eat or who they wear, for example, and that factors into their the decisions they make. And once again, uniformly, I would say that factory farms do not treat their animals very well, and they're really not farms. I mean, one of the things that was brought out to me recently in a discussion with a woman who I really don't agree with her on a lot of things, but she runs what she calls a family farm. And I know the animals there are treated far better than they are on a factory farm. And she said that she was really upset that industrial agriculture, you know, in terms of the food industry, were called factory farms because they're not farms at all. And it really shed bad light on her.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks so much for your time, Mark Beckoff. And thanks very much, Stephen Blackburn. Dorothy, I'm just going to come back to you for a second here, because I think you and I are beholding a similar spectacle at the moment, which is that on the one hand, Kevin gave me some really great looking pork chops when he came here, which I'm really looking forward to eating. On the other hand, I'm really enjoying the companionship of Rosie. I mean, even just sort of in this moment that we're sitting in right now, where we're confronted on the one hand with this completely adorable and interesting and curious animal. On the other hand, the pork chops look really good. And I have every intention of eating them. I don't know. How do people reconcile these things?
Enjoying them. I think for most part, there's a disconnect. I don't want to think about the animal as it was living. I don't want to think about this animal as a creature when you're sitting down to dinner. I think that we have an amazing ability to put things in blocks and not go across it, because when you see somebody like Rosie or you see a baby of any species, they're just so exquisite. The thought of eating one of them is just horrific for many of us, and yet once it comes to dinner, whether you're talking a roast or you're talking a steak or you're talking a pork chop, there's an ability to just put that out of your mind and just enjoy the meal at the moment. I think that's how so many of us are able to eat meat.
All right, let me grab a call here from Rob. Our number, by the way, 860-275-7266. In our final segment, we're going to come back to the farmers a little bit more, talk about pigs, talk about what else there is to know about them. You'll also be getting some cautioning from Julie against the idea of having one of these adorable animals in your own life. Here's Rob from New Haven. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Colin. Just got to say, love the show.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. One thing, my father, for about 15 years, what you'd used to call a gentleman farmer. Came from New York City, executive job, became a farmer. One of the things he did is he raised pigs for slaughter.
And what did he draw any conclusions about them, Rob?
Well, he knew they were really smart. Hmm. I mean, he had what they called free range pigs, where they had a large area to roam around and do what they wanted to do, and basically they were never corralled except during the winter time so they wouldn't die in the snow. But they were really protective of each other, and pretty much didn't get harassed by any of the coyotes or anything like that. They didn't need any of their guard donkeys to keep the other coyotes or whatnot at bay. They knew not to mess with a pig.
That is a very interesting point, and I'm going to ask the farmers when we come back about this too, because I know where Nevin's farm is located, and there's coyotes and bears and everything else coming out of the woods. All right, so we'll just grab a quick break here. When we come back, by the way, our phone number, if you want to talk about pigs, 860-275-7266. Then one day, jamming on some chords, along came the wolf, knocking on his door.
You know, if there's one thing I don't like, it's a pig with a superior attitude. Ever since you beat me in chess, Rosie, you've been acting all high and mighty. So if you're so smart, what's 9 times 7? 63? Betsy, is that the right answer?
Yep, 63.
Okay, apparently that was a lucky guess on your part. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me with help from our intern, Jackie Lauper. The part of Bill Curry was played by Kermit the Frog. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin. For links, articles, and photos of the Faith Middleton Show staff dressed up as Winnie the Pooh characters, go to WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, The Nose talks about happiness, Duck Dynasty, and Netflix adultery. And now, back to Colin.
I don't want to alarm anybody. Netflix adultery is when your significant other or perhaps just your friend watches something that you're both supposed to watch together but sort of does it without you, doesn't wait for you. All right, so that'll be part of our conversation tomorrow. Our number right now, 860-275-7266. Let me set the scene. We have four farmers and one sort of theologian/therapist here in the studio and one pig, Rosie. Rosie is a pot-bellied pig, and she's creating so much excitement that Lucy and Tucker are both at the window looking into the studio, which is something they don't typically do when we're on the air. And we're talking about pigs. As we go along here, I'm going to actually ask the farmers a little bit. Since some of us have made a decision, possibly reversible, that we're going to eat pigs, we'll find out a little bit about what parts of the pig are really good to eat and all that kind of stuff. But before that, you know, I mean, Abby, I'm going to just ask you, and I don't know why I'm singling you out exactly, but to help me reconcile – I mean, the thing I was talking about before, okay, so I'm really looking forward to some pork chops from your farm, but I'm also really enjoying Rosie's company. You live on a farm, you work on a farm, you see these animals every day. You also are ultimately preparing them for a life as meat one of these days. So how do you reconcile all that? How do you, you know, I mean, as you get to know pigs and they're really kind of interesting and they're really kind of smart, what do you do with that?
I mean... You know when you get them that they're going to be food. I mean, so you already have that thought in your head. So, I don't know. I mean, we always name our animals. We always have fun choosing out the names for which animal's which and that type of thing. But you eat it. Like, you can go to the grocery store and you can buy the meat and you don't put the thought into what animal it came from or how the animal lived in how miserable their life could have been, when I'm going to sit here and I'm going to make my pig as happy as possible and have delicious pork at the end of the season.
Mm-hmm. No, I get that, actually. And it does. I think you also are a little bit more aware of the animal and the animal's ultimate sacrifice if you're sort of involved with the animal on that level and on a daily basis.
Yeah, and we just like to give them, like, a happy life. Like, I mean, I know that we're just going to kill them in the end, but that's the way of life. That's how you're supposed... Like, we eat both animals and plants. Like, it's the human nature of things. That's what happens.
I gotcha. We're going to come back to some things about that. But, you know, as long as somebody brought this up, Nevin, and just sort of grab the mic over here and then give it back to Julie because I have a question for her as well. But you know, somebody was mentioning this whole idea of pigs being able to ward off coyotes or not needing any protection from coyotes. I know where you live. I know where your farm is. There's a lot of wild animals out there. There's bears and stuff like that. Are pigs really that tough that you don't have to –
Pigs are pretty much solid muscle, and they have teeth, and they don't want anybody eating them until after you kill them. So we have had zero problems, I dare say, with pigs. We've had predators for other animals, but even the pigs, when they were roaming the acre and a half area next to the woods compost piles, zero problems.
All right.
Those moms, dads, big, tough.
All right, we have a caller who's got a different story to tell about that. We'll do that in just a second. But Julie, take the mic back, because I don't want to miss out on this. This is, you know, the minute Rosie came in here. Rosie's a pot-bellied pig. She's adorable. She's great. We're all enjoying her. She's created this huge stir in the building, and it makes you think, wow, this is, you know, they're great. Maybe I should get one. No?
Oh, yeah. She's wagging her tail. If you rub her belly, she'll flop down like a big dog.
She and Abby really bonded a little while ago.
And she's cute.
She's a fantastic pet. However, a lot of people get these pets when they're super small and super easy to take care of. And then they grow up to be, what, about 100, 150 pounds, some of them? And they start neglecting them. They become a little bit mean. We've gotten call after call for people wanting, you know, us to adopt their pot-belly pig. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm sure there's a lot of great pot-belly pig owners, especially George Clooney. He's a hottie. But you have to really commit to this animal. It's kind of like people who get bunnies. You know, the same thing. The second the cold weather comes, oh, I don't want to deal with that. Yeah. So it's a commitment.
Yeah. I mean, the reason you have Rosie is because of this, right?
Well, yes. She was someone's pet that they took very, very good care of her. That's why she's so socialized. But, you know, she becomes a chore. She needs to go outside. And so a farm is an easier place for a pig to live than somebody's house.
We get some great calls here, and I want to get to them. But before we do that, though, you know, I should say I do buy all of my pork from farms like Four Mile River Farm or Hurricane Farm out in Scotland, or now I'm going to forget all the names of the farms, or Eaglewood or Eaglebrook, whatever it's called in Barkhamsted, the Finns. But you know, a lot of times I don't know. I just buy whatever looks good or something. Kevin, maybe you could just sort of say a little bit about. I mean, for example. What is bacon, actually? And there's, like, different kinds of bacon, right?
Yeah, there's jowl bacon, which comes out of the jowl of the pig, which is a very tasty bacon. Mm. There's your regular bacon, comes off the back of the pig. Mm. You pull it right off the sides, comes right off the outside of the ribs, right up to the top. Then you have your Canadian bacon, which I actually had somebody smoke me some of that, and it is a very tasty bacon.
That comes from Canadians, actually. The pigs are not involved.
Sent my pigs up to Canada for the summer and then brought them back.
Well, as long as you said that, we should make one thing clear, too, which is that no matter what kind of farmer you are or who you are, you can't slaughter your own pigs, right? They have to go to a...
No, you can, but you cannot sell them to the public. You have to go to a USDA slaughterhouse.
So what kind of turnaround is that for you? In other words, the pigs leave. They don't come back the same day as me.
No, they do not. It takes 2 weeks to get the fresh meat, 3 weeks to get everything. And usually we just end up waiting until we have – it's because it's a three-hour round trip for us to the slaughterhouse. Mm-hmm. And we wait until everything's done and then just go pick it up at once, bring it back. Mm-hmm. And we do run out quite quickly. I mean, this year was our first year doing it, and we weren't quite prepared to sell as much as we actually did.
Mm-hmm. What's the? I don't think it's a food schmooze on Faith Middleton today. But what's the best cut of pork? What do you?
I like the loin. Loin chops or your loin itself. And anybody else got anything on that?
I'll go with the underutilized and underappreciated shoulder chops. You get a little. The bones, they're bony, a lot of cartilage, and that's my kind of eating. I think the best meat is near the bone. You have to have teeth, however.
Yeah.
All right, let's grab some calls here. Maybe we can start out with something of a historical nature. Here's Phil in Cheshire. Hi, Phil.
Hi, how are you?
Just fine. What's on your mind?
I just couldn't let this conversation go by without bringing up the quote of Winston Churchill, who said, "I like pigs. Dogs look up to us. Cats look down on us. Pigs treat us as equals."
All right. Well, the farmers are nodding here. That, you know, that may make a certain amount of sense to them. Let me grab a call from Suzanne in New York. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. I'm on the New York State line near New Milford, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And last summer, a large bear had to be killed out of season because it had, I think it was more than one attack, but it killed quite a few piglets. You know, and I think it came back for a second dose of piglets. Someone who had raised pigs before never had trouble with the bear, and they were corralled. You know, so everyone was pretty surprised, but it was just a bloody mess. And
I'm covering Rosie's ears while you're talking. I don't want her to hear this.
Yeah, anyway, so we do have plenty of bear come by. A lot of them have a little green tag that's from Connecticut. This was the first that I had heard of this type of thing. And the other thing is I know that a lot of the states, including New York, have had to get their Department of Conservation to have a committee. They're studying the damage caused by feral pigs. Apparently there's a big feral pig population on Long Island. A lot of the southeastern states have pigs that are just damaging, you know, a lot of places, the Smokies National Park and stuff.
Yeah, other parts of the country, feral pigs have become this huge problem. In fact, we tried to do a show that was about a year ago, that was going to encompass the whole feral pig question, and it had become so sensitive that it was almost impossible to book guests. Like, the government officials didn't want to talk about it, the scientists didn't want to talk about it. Apparently, it's kind of an issue, like, what to do about these feral pigs and how to keep them from destroying everything around them. And it's gotten to be an area of high sensitivity. As we go through these calls, if you guys have anything you want to say, just like raise a hand or something.
I just wanted to ask her.
Yeah,
was the sow in with these piglets when
it
got killed?
I think Suzanne just hung up, but I think that was the question that I had too.
Because
your experience, right, is the sow will not let this stuff happen. Bear or no bear.
Yeah, we were trying to give shots once to some piglets, and that mother sow heard her piglets screaming.
Yeah.
Or maybe we were castrating the boy, something. But she came, came flying.
Let's say it was shots.
Yeah,
she came flying out a window. And the guy that was helping us was like 250 pounds. I've never seen him run so fast, squealing like a girl.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
They can be nasty when they're protective.
Protecting their babies.
And what I've read and I think even heard talking to other farmers too is that almost any mother of any species will protect her litter, her cubs, or whatever. But I mean, pigs protect each other that's the sense that I've had anyway, that pigs are social enough so that they'll protect another pig who isn't related to them. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
I haven't come across that yet. I mean, they will, like, if you get your pigs and you have them all in the pen corralled together, and you go in there and you're hurting one, the other ones will come over and like push at you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't had any bite me yet.
All right.
Not on, you know.
Good.
Yeah.
All right.
I got all my fingers.
Yeah. Let's talk to Pete in New Britain. Hi, Pete. You're on the air.
Hey, what's going on today?
Well, it's pigs mainly, as it turns out.
Aha. We actually, my father would, you know, raise a pig every once in a while for slaughter, and they were extremely smart. I remember as a kid, we'd play hide and seek in the fields. You know, we'd chase after each other. He'd come when I call him, and he got to the size of would make my German Shepherd look small.
Yeah. and any other particular experience? So this is, well, first of all, what was the pig's name? I feel like I need to know that. Or
it
did
Arnold.
It
happen?
What was it?
Arnold.
All right. You know, it's sort of another thing we didn't really have time to go into today is just the amount of sort of literature and mythology around pigs. I mean, there's Wilbur, there's Babe, there's Gub-Gub, there's Piglet, there's, you know, I mean, we're sort of confronted constantly. All of our childhood literature is sort of about all these amazing animals. We have just a little bit of time left, like almost sort of just about enough time to say goodbye to everybody and say thank you. So why don't we just do that mainly? First of all, over at Flamig Farm, is the farm open at this time of year? Can people come in and look at all the animals and stuff like that?
No, actually, we're closed at this point. We had a slip and fall a while ago, so my insurance company got a little more nervous than they normally were.
Mm-hmm.
So we're keeping people away until April-ish when we'll reopen in full swing.
All right. In April, we're doing an emu show, so you can bring the emu in. Emus really aren't nice, right? My sense of emus is that they just want to destroy us.
For the most part. But we do have one that is – we probably could bring it in.
All right.
It would make it.
All right. Well,
at
we'll
this
talk.
Point anyway.
Yeah, we'll talk. And you guys are, Abby, maybe you want to go through this. You guys are still selling, right, at Killam and Bassett. So you're doing a farmer's market Saturday. That's what I was trying to remember.
Yep, we have the Glastonbury Farmer's Market at the Old Cider Mill. We're open from 10 to 1. But we do have a stand down at 14 Tryon Street in South Glastonbury. We're open every day of the year from 8 to about 7,
six.
6, 7, yeah. Whatever.
And, depending on daylight.
Yeah. And we do all the seasonal fruits and vegetables. We have the pork. We have free-range eggs.
Jam,
we have
pickles.
Homemade jam, pickles, applesauce, pear sauce, zucchini relish.
All right. There's everything. So thanks to everybody. Thanks to Dorothy Martin-Neville, too. Thanks to all the other guests we had on by phone. Thanks to Kaio and Wolf, who put this whole show together. And thanks to Rosie for keeping us company here in the studio.
Take me to the water. and I'll swim like a rip snorter. So I filled the bath with water and said I kept me word, you see. Pigs can't swim and pigs can't fly, but pigs can see the wind go by. Pigs make lovely household friends when winter comes and summer ends. Are you proud of me, I asked him.
I'm Kyone Wolf. Okay, Rosie, I've got some math problems for you. What's the answer to Beale's conjecture? Okay, are there infinitely many Fibonacci primes? Okay, does the consistency of the existence of a strongly compact cardinal imply the consistent existence of a super compact cardinal? Oh, do you know freaking everything, Rosie?